Remembering that our speaker tonight was born in Portland, Oregon, and that he later served as a missionary in the Pacific Northwest, I thought it would be appropriate to say a few words about the history of the church in the Northwest. That seems particularly appropriate this year, since it was exactly 100 years ago that the migration of Latter-day Saints into Washington and Oregon began. Three Cache Valley men, David Eccles, John Stoddard, and Charles W. Nibley, Hugh's grandfather, saw opportunities for Latter-day Saint laborers in the lumber industry and founded the Oregon Lumber Company. All three of these brethren were Scottish and were industrious, enterprising, and visionary. All three had a dry Scottish wit that was keen and incisive. In addition to the Oregon Lumber Company, these three built the Sumter Valley and Mount Hood Railroads, established lumber mills at several locations in Oregon and Washington, built beet sugar factories, farm machinery shops, flour mills, canneries, banks, and many other enterprises. They provided employment for hundreds of Cache Valley and Weber Valley Saints who migrated to Oregon country to work and to homestead land. Among these, incidentally, were the grandparents of Chase Peterson. Wards were organized, later a state, in all of which the Nibleys played a leadership role. Hugh's grandfather was a counselor in the first state presidency in Oregon. Hugh's uncle Preston was later president of the mission. His father Alex, besides filling two missions to the Netherlands, including one as mission president, was an early president of the Portland branch into which Hugh was born. Agnes Nibley, Hugh's mother, was a counselor in the presidency of the Portland Relief Society, organized in 1903. The president of the Northwest Mission at the time Hugh was born was Elder Melvin J. Ballard, grandfather of our present Apostle Russell Ballard. With unusual oratorical powers, a pleasant singing voice, a willingness to respond to the demands of the people, and complete dedication to the cause of the Savior, he was one of the great evangelists of this dispensation, and his start began in the Pacific Northwest. A report by Elder Ballard in the Liahona, the Elder's Journal, tells of an incident that occurred in Portland the very year Hugh was born. Just before meeting was to start, an old gentleman entered the church and gave his name as Peter Morrison and said he was 97 years old. He said he had lived for several years with Joseph Smith Sr. and was well acquainted with the prophet Joseph Smith. Invited to speak to the saints, he bore testimony that he knew Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, and we could tell by the change in his countenance every time he had a vision, he said. He said he had tried twice to be baptized, but both times something happened to prevent it. When the prophet died, he said, his light went out, but he had a testimony of the truth and wanted to be baptized now. Elder Ballard then concludes by saying, he declares he always has and always will bear his testimony to the work and character of the prophet. After his baptism and confirmation, Elder Ballard said, he declared it to be one of the happiest days of his life. The Northwest has enjoyed many manifestations of the Spirit and has produced many great personalities. And one of the greatest of these is our speaker tonight.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that so much. Now we'd like to call on our member, Dr. Bill Pope, to introduce the speaker.
Dr. Nibley says that I could correct some of that. He also made the remark when he knew that Leonard Harrington was going to give a vignette I hope that Leonard's up to his usual standard of good, accurate history. I was first introduced to Dr. Hugh Nibley as a young elder when we were studying his book, Lehigh in the Desert. And it was 3 or 4 years later that Margaret and I went to Iran and became acquainted with the Arab people. And it wasn't until then that I recognized how great that book had been in letting us know the nature of the people of the Middle East. But then later, as I joined Brigham Young University, I met Dr. Nibley, and he was a true, rugged, unchanging character. And the first thing I remember of Professor Nibley was I saw him walking on the campus. He had a book in his hand. He wasn't looking at the book, but he was lecturing, and he was walking rather rapidly, and about 20 students were trying to follow him and take notes and get close enough so that they could hear what he was saying. Later, Margaret and I took the occasion to sit in on two of his graduate classes. And it was one of the fascinating and interesting experiences of my life. He not only gave his lecture, but he gave 4 or 5 side lectures on the significance of the olive tree, the symbolism, the how rugged it was, and there was a professor who came from Harvard. He was Professor David Reisman. Professor Reisman he had the title Harvard Professor. When Professor Reisman wanted to teach, he taught. When he wanted to travel, he traveled. When he wanted to do research, he did research, and he was an expert in the field of sociology. He came to Brigham Young University, gave a talk, and was later hosted at a luncheon. He sat next to Dr. Nibley. Dr. Nibley talked to him during the luncheon, and at the end of the luncheon, Mark Cannon, who many of you know, who was the host, said Dr. Reisman turned to him and said, "Who is this man, Hugh Nibley?" He said he not only knew more about every subject we discussed, he knew more about my field than I did. So I think that's enough. I was just going to, I know that you're as anxious to hear him as I am, because the subject of his talk is what we should do. And then he added to me in the hereafter, that, so I can't wait. Well, after Brother Pate's prayer from Brother Arrington and Bill's introductions, I feel like the trembling the trembling prologue to Shakespeare's play, which says, "The pardon, gentles all," with some paraphrasing of Shane, "the pardon, gentles all, the flat upraised spirit that has dared in this unworthy person to bring forth so great an object." And of course, I'm going to talk about a page of the gospel of which I've become very interested recently. The last time I spoke here was 7 years ago. It's a sort of 7-year itch to get around there. And it was on the subject of a preacher. You don't mind if I read this to you? It goes much faster this way, since all my cerebral processes come to an abrupt halt after I've eaten something. Like a python. The last time I spoke to this August group, it was on the subject of the free lunch. Of course, I knew there's no free lunch, but I wish to point out the price varies. I cited the case of my great-grandparents who toiled their lives away in the mines of Scotland just for lunch and nothing else. They were not even allowed to take off time to eat it. This is really true. Lest they infringe on the rightful claims of the mine owners to their time and labor. On the other hand, I learned from a leading article in the current issue of the Scientific American. Oh, I have some displays here which I can get. This is the first one. It's this one. Surgeon in Columbus. It is the current issue of the Scientific American. And there we read these interesting statistics. The top 2% of the population have 28% of the total net worth. Well, we'll get to the gospel, don't worry. Well, the top, I've got to get this here, though. To this one, well, the top 50% have 4.5% of the total net. The top 10% have 57% of the net worth. And the bottom 50% have 4.5% of the net worth. About, continuing the quotation, about half the country's top wealth holders got there by inheriting their holdings. Would it seem irreverent to suggest that some of those fortunate people enjoy something remotely akin to a free lunch? Somebody always pays for the lunch, and it's obvious that some people eat a lot of lunches that others pay for, while others pay for a lot of lunches they never eat. Naturally, you don't want to spend your life in shallows and in miseries. You'll notice Shakespeare all the way through. Like my grandfather, I can't leave him alone. He does it so much better than I, modestly in love, much better than I do. Your lives in shallows and in miseries, and the thing to do is to get into the upper brackets, no matter how, as the Roman poet says, just so you get there. Mr. Ivan Boisky visited various college campuses, preaching to the youth on the merits of what he called cultivating a healthy greed. But before all else, the terrifying assurance implicit in the smug free lunch maxim that without money you were dead, while with it you can have anything in this world, has turned everyone in mass almost overnight. Now, this is a recent development. You'll notice this too. Almost overnight, from whatever ideals and goals may have lingered from previous generations, to one thing only. From interviews with the class of 87, Haynes Johnson discovered that security is what they want. He says, not some fuzzy notion of security either, but financial security. There's a mass shifting. We know this in the school down there. Of majors from liberal arts to business, the reaction of the students to the insider trading scandals was a quick reply. In a tone of dismissal, most of us just want a piece of the action. As they spoke, he says, their conversations took on a chilling quality and was filled with a string of spontaneous rationalizations. The end justifies the means. They all do it. Dog eat dog. Those who can't make it don't deserve to. Well, that's nice. Don't deserve to. Whiners, losers, so forth. Versus winners. It's not that what you know, but who you know. Get out of my way. I'm number one, crushing law of the jungle. And this, he concludes the interviewer, from an era that was supposed to produce a rekindling of American values. A few weeks ago, 60 Minutes showed the inability of a group of typical California college students to answer the most elementary questions on geography and history and literature and politics and so forth, the world we live in. Were the students ashamed of their ignorance and on the fundamentals? Well, no, not a bit of it. Contrary, they were indignant and indifferent when challenged. Why should we learn that stuff, they asked. Why should we know anything about faraway times and places? And I get asked this all the time. They could see no point in being concerned with anything that is not right here, at hand, and in the hand. We want it all, and we want it now. That's the slogan. And here's a gem I just picked up from the last issue of Mademoiselle. I hope you've all seen it. I'll read it to you. Now, this is an example of where we are. And here's a girl called Sandy, and this is what it says. It was easy taking him away from you was a breeze. I deserve him. Well, he starts out, kiss him goodbye, Maggie. It was easy taking him away from you was a breeze. I deserve him. I have the best things in life, cars, boats, and I now him. He's so hot that he'll cool off for now, but he'll have to cool off for now. You've got to find yourself another guy, Maggie. He's mine now. I deserve him. I have the cars, the boats, and I have him now. Now, they took that. That's an ad. It was an ad for designer jeans, of course. You can read it in your life. That's what it is. Intelligence, says William James, is the ability to react to an absent stimulus or absent stimuli. The cockroach and the mouse act to what is immediately around them and no more. Yet thou art blessed compared with me, said we got to get Burns in here too with all the discussion. That thou art blessed compared with me, that the present only touches thee, he says. How oft I backward cast my E. On prospects drear and forward, though I cannot see, I doubt and fear. I guess and fear is what he says. I guess and fear. Well, see, the poet, we don't like that. They don't like this sort of thing. They like to be more like the mouse. Our present day grads want none of that. The more intelligent animals know that it pays to heed the rumble of the distant drum, like floodwaters advancing from far up the canyon. Survival depends on it. That's why the new generation are letting themselves be dangerously exposed. The great tragedy is, perhaps, that no one, including the teachers, ever told them why they should be interested in anything but money. The state of mind has been building up for a number of years with steady encouragement of the use of science to become financially independent as their first project in life. To be financially dependent at 30 has become as reprehensible as to be unwed. President Kimball exposed the roots of that evil in an inspired address to the church and the nation on the occasion of the National Bicentennial. He said it was
What he saw appalled and frightened him by what he saw around him. He singled out three primary objects: contempt for the environment, quest for affluence, and trust in deadly weapons. All three of these, and all three of these vices, Utah leads the nation. I will not harrow your minds by reading a long list of appalling statistics I have on the subject. I left them alone. That would be wise. Suffice it to say that what was designed to be Zion has turned out to be the purges of Babylon. For us, the environment and ecology are dirty words, blocking access to the wealth of the land, which is meant for corporate developers, working in the service of self-image as the money, and that includes, we're quoting President Kimball now, includes sufficient money, stocks, bonds, investment portfolios, property, credit cards, furnishings, automobiles, and the like, the ad we just read, to guarantee carnal security throughout it is hoped a long and happy life, to quote President Kimball, has given us a mindset that is firmly grounded in our first article of faith: you can have anything in this world for money. And thirdly, implicit trust in the military hardware gives us the means of keeping the whole thing going. Worldwide markets with mining, well, you know all this, with mining production and consumption continuing to spread the gospel of virtuous violence until the consumption decreed hath made a full end of all nations, as the Doctrine and Covenants taught, 57th section. Well, I'm going to skip the next unpleasantness. No, this is important, because I have another exhibit to go with it. The price we pay for these three items is staggering. The price we pay for the first is the loss of this earth, most glorious and beautiful of which all, desired from the foundations to be a place of variety and beauty. The price we pay for the second, setting our hearts on riches, is truth and virtue. Who is not aware of this today? A recent issue of U.S. News and World Report devoted its cover story to the theme, quote, an alarming decline in basic honesty. And this is what the issue was, the cover story: the nation of liars, question mark. This is what we're turning into, according to this article. And here's a brochure which promises to sell you a maverick liars. Well, I just wish it here. But it will interest you. The person who gave this to me, I'll tell you where it came from, Brother Russell Peake here. And it's this. Money-making secrets. Well, it says here, money-making secrets of this millionaire client. A maverick liar is willing to reveal the money-making secrets of his millionaire clients. We'll just read it here. You need to know how the most successful people in the world operate their well-oiled money machines in acquiring enormous wealth at an incredibly fast rate. And then he tells us that you don't have to have any systematic step-by-step formula for making large amounts of money on a regular basis. And the best thing, it doesn't require any special background or qualifications, things like that. Again, I smell a free lunch there. Now, virtue goes down the drain as truth, of course. And the author of this, the pitch man for this plan for making large amounts of money regularly, is the bishop of a BYU ward. See, this is the sort of thing that gets said down there. And the price we pay for the third obsession with the evil ways of other nations is life itself. Here we see the Mahan principle at work in all its glory. Truly, I am Mahan, the master of that great secret that I mean murder and get gain. From international drug and market and arms traffic to the sneaky chemical additions in the supermarket, the principle applies: life exchange for profits. One example will suffice. This month, the headline announces that a radiation dump could bring cash to the county, and it's the Utah County here. Some counties actually clamor to convert the lands of Bountiful into land desolation for a quick buck. To avoid such, here is an idealistic appeal, incidentally, to students to get interested in a new Master of Public Administration program for selfless and dedicated public service. And is this
or that? Well, it doesn't make any difference. It is, it says, it's a pipe, and it says, bring, oh, here it is. This is selfless service. Bring your brain in for big bucks. That's our BYU, come on, for our idealistic latter day thank you. Well, we could go on with this, but, no end. Now we've got to get to something positive, is all. But it's very necessary. The cure for all such ills, of course, is the gospel. But nobody explained that, even to our BYU students. Why is this? Dr. J. Curl, who is the Dean of Honors at BYU and also of General Education and Professor of Economics and Law, he reports the situation in the intro-issue of BYU studies. He says, it's pretty clear that we have a student body who come here only for job training. They're bright, they're capable, but they're not interested in liberal arts. I visit high schools in an effort to help recruit good students. Tell me about your dreams and aspirations and hopes.
It is always money and a job. None of them dreams of becoming educated people. That just never comes up. Institutionally, it appears we are committed to a different model than our students seem to be. Just yesterday, we heard it was announced over KUTV that Utah has more teenagers working outside of school than any other state. Earlier, it was reported that Utah pays less for a child's education than any other state in the Union. That's great for the employers who pay the lowest wages and taxes possible, but as the report noted, it tends to produce young people who are both poorly educated and materialistic, qualities which I found over many years of teaching large Sunday school classes to be conspicuous among their elders. Now, last semester, now we get to the subject. Last semester, to find out whether an honors class had remarkably developed students as their final children to be, very good test, whether they made any connection between the gospel and their careers, I asked them for a midterm assignment to assume that they're guaranteed 1,000 years of uninterrupted life here on earth, with all their wants and needs adequately funded. How would they plan to spend the rest of their lives here? I explained this is not a hypothetical question, since it's the very situation the gospel puts us in. Whether we want to or not, we're doomed to live forever, as Alma tells us, for they cannot die, even the wicked. And accepting the gospel, we are already launched into our eternal program. We can take covenants and receive ordinances for those who are on the other side already, because they're the very same covenants and ordinances we take on this side. When Elijah announced the establishment of the work, it was with the ringing words, "The time is fully come." We no longer ask when then, but only what. We are taught to think ourselves here and now as living in eternity, and how can it be otherwise, since the contracts we make and the rules we live by are expressly for time and eternity. So I asked them, how are you going to get started on that 1,000-year introduction to a timeless existence? After reading Professor Curl's report, I should have known what to expect. Here are some typical answers. I thought them all along, actually. There are 100, so we won't go into that. One, I'm overwhelmed by the proposition. I'd have to refuse it. Now I would have to explain to this person that as Merle 9:10-8, it says, deny not the gifts of God, and the greatest of these gifts is eternal life. Are you going to turn it down? Sorry, you can't, it's too late now. First, and then next, another person said, first I would go crazy, then I would be bored after 100 years. It would be like John the 3 Nephi. Another says, I would not want to live here that long. I would make a long-term investments in the money market. I would complete my education in business, get an MBA, would find a part-time job, and teach my children the value of work. And of course, all this is precluded, of course, by the premise here. Yet these students have been so brainwashed that they failed completely to see the point. Another says, it would be a dubious honor to prolong this probationary existence. And when, I ask him, are you going to be off probation if the angels that kept not their first estate fell? We're always going to be on probation. Of course, we believe in eternal probation. We believe in eternal probation, don't we? Another person said, it's not a nice question. The pressure would be too great from people who would like money from me. How should I be tithing on it? How would I use all that money? For this person, the whole thing, of course, is economic. The other person says, I would spend my time in recreation with some serious moments. For a sense of success, I might build or write something. Another says, I don't know if I would want 1,000 years. Travel and study and teach. Well, I say, well, you signed up for the duration, and now you want out? You can't do it, you see. Another said it could be a blessing or a cursing. Would excel in athletics and general education, would procrastinate a good deal, live the lifestyles of the well-to-do, shopping, camping, dancing, for 1,000 years. Another, they can't think of anything else. Another, first I would pay tithing, I would stay out of debt. How to use the funding money is the problem. Another thing says, I would do nearly everything there is to do several times over, perform service, and drive a Porsche 911. I suppose things wear out in less than 90 years, you know. I can't imagine changing things much. Another person says, I'm content with the path I am following. This person says quite bluntly, I would turn it down. This life is okay, but I'm anxious to get on with my progression in the hereafter. Of course, that's the whole point. Doing what? This is your progression into the hereafter. And so that's the subject of the talk. And so it goes. A TV documentary on missionaries last Sunday, I'm sure you nearly all saw it, the church declared that more is expected of us than any generation. Yet nothing could be further from the minds of these young people than the teaching of the prophet Joseph Smith, the things of God are of deep import, and time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts only can find them out. Thy mind, O man, must stretch as high as the utmost heaven. They don't seem to realize that. We need such knowledge even for survival. Again, the prophet. The saints ought to lay hold of every door to obtain foothold on earth and be making all preparation that is within their power for the terrible storms that are now gathering in the heavens. Any among you who aspire after their own aggrandizement and seek their own opulence while their brethren are groaning in poverty, cannot be benefited by the intercession of the Holy Spirit. Students today read such suggestions as alien and hostile. They really do. I get a lot of them. Well, what do these people do? What do we do in an eternal society? A recent news item, typical one of these days, tells of a once flourishing mill town in the South, in which the population find themselves with all the time in the world on their hands. And what do? They spend their days watching videotapes. Instead of exploiting an opportunity for the plain living and high thinking that led to the intellectual flowering of New England long ago, they fall back on the paralyzing theatromania, the Roman word, the mania for spectacles, theatromania, which was the final comfort of the last days of Rome. President Lee, L.B. Lee, once addressed a group of us in the religion teachers at BYU. He just attended a state conference and told us how at the meeting of the High Council, the question of the hereafter came up. One of the group, an undertaker, humorously noted that he would have to change his profession. Upon this, a dentist chimed up and confessed that he was in the same case. Next, an insurance man, there's always one of them there, admitted that there would be not much call for his talents, and then a used car salesman saw only limited prospects for his own business, and so on. So it went. As did the never-failing real estate pusher in the group, and if these men were not to dedicate themselves to making money, what would they do? 1,000 years of guaranteed livelihood ruled out the necessity of almost all the professions, businesses, and industries that thrive on the defects of our bodies and the insecurity of our lives. And Brigham Young often pointed this out, too. He says, don't think the angels are doing what we're doing, speculating, building railroads, and so forth. You won't do that. We can't. Not a question. Well, needless to say, my students were quick to put me on the spot. Aha, wise guy. What would you do? Fortunately, I have a whole corpus of scriptures and ordinances to the restored gospel to fall back on. In the scriptures, we are told that the Son does just what the Father does, and in time it shall be our calling to do the same works of the Father. And how do we go about it? Last Saturday, I left the temple loaded with instructions, specific instructions. I found it all laid out for me because I was looking for it. That's always the way it is in the temple, as you know. I had the question put to me point blank, and I wondered if I could get some hints from the scriptures and in the temple, and what I found is practically nothing else but prescriptions for things to do. First of all, in the teachings, in all the scriptures, and in the house of God, we are given to understand that there are certain things we must do and certain other things we must not do. The alternative to doing what God commands us to do, especially after our expressly agreeing to do it, is to be in Satan's power. For he has granted the authority to deceive and to blind and to leave them captive as his will, quoting Moses 4 and 5 here, even as many as will not hearken to my voice. There can be no compromise here. There's no third way. Then at the outset of our endeavors, we're given the satisfaction of knowing where this is all going to lead to, exaltation in the celestial kingdom of God. Since that is a vast distance, the way everything between now and then is preparatory in nature. It's all preparation. This rules out dedication to a career on this earth. A career is a carrière, one complete turn of the race course. You've not had a career, as each of us discovered, until it's over, until the thing is completed. The climb, the peak, the decline, the second childishness, and mere oblivion. We've got almost 2 pages of our 6, but that will never do. A more forlorn ambition than a career cannot be imagined. And years ago, President Stephen L. Richards made some scathing remarks in the old Smith Fieldhouse about the futility of aspiring to careers, a sentiment which I have rarely heard since then. We now give courses in career planning at the BYU. Then also, thirdly, from the beginning, we can expect to be tried and tempted. Satan's calling and appointment is to try to break us, to see at what point we'll give in, not be true and faithful in all things, to see how far we can be trusted in keeping the promises and covenants which cover the entire range of behavior. We can be assured that we're going to receive instructions all along. Next, we've been shown, when we have shown our capacity and willingness to keep one, we'll be given the next, which is somewhat harder. First, of course, is to agree to do things God's way instead of ours, to follow the law of God. This conditions our whole way of life and is expressed more specifically in what follows, the law of obedience to specific commands, which we receive through revelation, both in the scriptures and in the temple. This means that we would be called upon to make some sacrifice. Indeed, to please God, we must be willing to sacrifice all the way, taking Abraham for our model, as we read in the 132nd section, for a proper eternal life is not cheaply bought. We must be willing to give everything in full. Then again, a moral life with proper deportment and conduct at all times, uncompromising insistence on chastity, is a positive charge and a command which theoretically is supposed to be followed by all Christians, and of course all who accept the restored gospel. It determines not only how we shall act in our general conduct, but specifically what course we will steer through the waters of a wicked and adulterous generation, in which the mores and customs are no more, if they ever were, those of the celestial kingdom. It is not given unto you to live after the manner of the world, as I must live by the law of the celestial kingdom, otherwise I cannot receive her unto myself. Well, let's get down here. From the outside, the temple is anything but a practical structure, and the activity within is a great inconvenience and time consumer, with nothing to recommend it to our economy. Inversely, from the inside, the temple shenanigans, the shenanigans of the outside world look restless and absurd. Everything the exact opposite of what it is in the temple. Both worlds have one thing in common, neither